Anna, thank you, and thank you to the worship team. That was great. Last week, Steve showed a picture of me on the screen and then showed a picture of AJ, and he said that I was going to speak this week. And a gentleman sitting in front of me, and if you're here, bless you. God bless you. He turned around and said, "I thought I recognized you." He said, I didn't know your name, and he said, "And I heard you speak before, and I don't remember anything you said, but I do remember that you ride a motorcycle." So he gave me a blessing. So whoever you are, thank you, because I don't have any anxiety about this morning because you're not going to remember anything I say anyway. So I want to introduce you to a friend of mine, Jeanette Tompkins. That picture was taken 2 weeks ago in Reno, where she lives now. In that picture, I was 2 weeks into being 62, and she's 2 months short of being 92. I met Jeanette when I was 22 and she was 52 years old. I was new in my faith, kind of green behind the ears, didn't know my way around things, and she took me under her wing. And she kind of mentored me, and she has become a beloved friend of mine for the last 40 years. She taught Bible studies at 450 women in the Bay Area of Northern California for many, many years. And she is a testimony of somebody that I love to follow, somebody who follows Jesus and somebody who has leaned on his faithfulness. And we have story after story after story of times when we traveled together or spoke together. And one of those times was in the Middle East. We were in Cyprus, and she was speaking at the Middle East Ladies Prayer Seminar. 250 women were there from 17 Arab countries that had come to pray for their countries in the Middle East. They had to sneak out to get to where we were praying. And during that time, she gave her story translated in 5 languages to those 250 women. And her story is absolutely remarkable. She and her husband were flying their plane down to Southern California. He was a pilot, to drop their teenage sons at a Christian conference and then coming back to Danville, California, where they lived. And she said, he turned to her and he said, "Jeanette, I love you." And she turned to him and said, "Oh, buddy, I love you so." And if you could hear her voice, it's just like that. She said those were the last words they spoke. They hit a patch of fog unexpectedly, and Jeanette said she could hear the crack of the wing as the wing was sheared off by trees, and they crashed into the Danville Hills and came to a stop on a Catholic monastery grounds. He died that day, and she lived with her back broken in 2 places. She had 3 teenage sons and was in her late 40s. She went on in this talk to these women to explain how over the years God has been her husband in ways that she never expected, that God had been her husband. And as she shared, it was amazing to watch these women begin to respond to her. She never remarried, never owned a home, has lived on a widow's pension, and in her words, "I've never been in want." And so 2 weeks ago when we were at her house, I said, "So Jeanette, are you looking forward to dying and being with Jesus? That's only I can ask." She said, "Oh, yes, without a hesitation." And she goes, "I think about it every day." She says, "I'm not morbid about it. I love living." She's healthy. She drove me to the airport. She spends time with her children, her grandchildren, her great-grandchildren. But as we talked late into the night, I became aware of something that I've been meditating on for probably the last 2, 3, maybe even 4 years. When Jeanette first trusted Jesus, she came home. Jesus said, "Make your home in my love as I make my home in you." Yet paradoxically, she has been on her way home ever since. She's been on her way home ever since. God is our homeland. He is our homeland. He is our home. And the homing instinct of the human spirit is homed on God. St. Augustine put it this way: we must fly to our beloved homeland. There the Father is, and there is everything. Ultimately, our yearning for God is the most important aspect of our humanity. It's our most precious treasure. It gives our existence meaning, and it gives our existence purpose. Pascal, the great physicist and philosopher from France, made the comment, and the well-known comment's famous, there's a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every person, and it can't be filled by anything created, but only by God the Creator, made known through Jesus Christ our Lord. So what I want to talk about this morning is coming home, is coming home. When we put even a tiny mustard seed of faith in Jesus, we are home. But we are on a journey home every moment of our lives. And I don't pretend to understand this mystery in any way. But perhaps this morning, as I encourage my own heart and yours, we can look at a couple of verses in the book of Hebrews. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. Those three verses are referring back to Hebrews chapter 11. And Hebrews chapter 11 is the famous hall of fame of people of faith in the Old Testament. And if you read Hebrews 11, you hear those wonderful words, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And then the writer talks about all these wonderful people of faith, Abraham, Moses, Rahab, you name it. And he ends with people we don't have names for, people that were tortured, that wandered in the desert, that didn't have a place to call home, people of whom the world was not worthy. Those are our witnesses. And what that means is those people witnessed all of us here this morning about God's faithfulness. You can make it. You can do it. They did it. There are people that have gone on from you that are your witnesses. It's like an arena, metaphorically, like at Autzen Stadium, and we're the runners down there on the track, and we're running a race. We're on our way home. We're on our way home. And so as I read those three verses, a couple things popped out at me. One is we're to run light. We're to run light. Lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance a race that is set before us. Awful lot of stuff in that verse. I mean, that verse alone, and I love God's word. It comes alive. But the point I want to make on this verse is that when you're running, you don't put a lot of stuff on. You run light. You don't want any resistance, so you put aside those things. And encumbrance just means any weight, anything that's going to weigh you down, anything that's going to bog you down. And the sin, which so easily entangles us. Now, if you know me very well, you know I'm not into sin management. I think it's an awful substitute for the gospel of Jesus Christ. The sin they're talking about here is the spirit of the age, the spirit of our culture. It's what we live in, what we breathe, what we eat. And it's saying here, sin in this sense is what turns us away from our longing for God, for our love for God, for one another and for ourselves. Our God-given desire for home gets attached and sometimes even addicted to what can never satisfy, to what can never satisfy. We're left ever longing and never satisfied. There are so many things in our culture, but I'm mentioning two that I get caught in. One is busyness. We are such a darn busy people. There's never downtime. There's never downtime. I call it the tyranny of the urgent. The tyranny of the urgent. I should be doing more. I should have done more. Surely in the future, I ought to be able to do more. And you know, when I get caught in the past, I should have done more, or in the future, I should be able to do more, I miss the present. And the present is where God is, and the present is where my experience of home is. And then when I'm right in that place, And I'm thinking, I should be doing more. I even missed that. And I'm kind of like the character Mr. Duffy in James Joyce's A Painful Case, where it says Mr. Duffy lived quite a distance from his body. No wonder we're all going crazy. And some people, even literally, there's no place to rest. Second thing that I think I have seen is that whole spirit of consumerism, and our society's built on this. When our financial institutions were on the brink of collapse, we poured more money we didn't have into the system to keep it going, to create jobs so that people could spend, so more jobs could be created, and on and on and on. Now, I say this not because I have any political statement about that. I don't. I am a therapist, not an economist, and I don't have a clue what the answer is to our economic woes. And it's complex. But it's the spirit of it all that I'm wanting to address. Acquire and accumulate. Get more, get ahead. And this spirit has permeated our lives, hijacking our most treasured possession and our deepest desire, our longing for God and our longing for home. That desire has gotten attached to more, M-O-R-E, more money, more things, more knowledge. I must acquire. When I was with Jeanette and I saw her contentment, and I have watched it over the years, she doesn't fake it, I realized, as Gerald May suggests in my favorite book I'm reading right now, Addiction and Grace, our journey home, our spiritual life, is not so much about acquisition as it is about relinquishment. Let me say that again. Our journey home is not so much about acquisition as it is about relinquishment, as it is about letting go. Next thing I saw is run looking, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter, the author being the beginner, the originator of our faith, the perfecter, he's going to finish it. Right there in that verse, I could just pull that verse apart. There's a partnership going on there. My job is to focus on him. His job is to deal with my faith. I've always had it backwards, kind of searching to see if I had enough faith. When I was in my internship, the first thing I learned as I was being taught how to teach a parenting class is that when you're trying to help a child be directed, the first thing you want to do is get eye contact. Get them to look you in the eye. So you get down on their level, you say their name, and when you've got them connected in the eyes, you have a 70 to 80% more likely chance that they'll follow your directions. There's always the other percentage, but it is still that. How many of you have ever watched those movies where someone's just fallen over the cliff and they're hanging like this and they're ready to go down, they're looking down at there and they're screaming, and the guy up here, they show his eyes and he's saying, don't look down, don't look down, don't look down, look at me, look at me. And then all they show is the music gets loud and it shows his eyes and it shows this guy's eyes, and they're locked together, and of course he's safe and he gets him up and everything's okay. But that's the concept here. Fix our eyes on Jesus. And here's how it goes for me. Let's take worry, for example, or anxiety. That is a particular weight that I struggle with. I tend to be a worrier and tend to have anxiety. So I'm looking to Jesus as best I know how in my day. And I'm focused on him, and all of a sudden over here this worry starts to niggle and grab my attention. And so I kind of glance over, and then I glance again, and then I start glancing, and before long, I get a cocktail party of thoughts and feelings just squirreling around in my brain. And I'm like this, and then it goes, and I lose my way, and I can't see him. So I have to let it go and bring it this way. Bring it this way. Last week, Steve was finishing his series on Philippians, and he talked about be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. Now, I used to think that I was sinning every time I worried or felt anxious. So what I would do is I would try to not feel so anxious. And I would try to do all kinds of things, like I'd confess it away. I would try and talk myself out of it. I would do all kinds of things. And you know what I have to say to that? Good luck. Good luck. It just got worse. Since then, I have come to see that verse not so much as a command, but as a wonderful invitation to come home, to bring it all home. Instead of over here, okay, here it is. Here it is. Here it is. That's what I've seen it as. This summer, I had an accident. My buddy, my hiking buddy, and my camping buddy, Betty Fletcher, and I were hiking and camping on our week's vacation. Now, we were in the Columbia Gorge, and we had just hiked 36 miles that week, and we were on our last day, and of course, we wanted to get one more mile in. And so we were just finishing a little short hike. We were about a mile into Latourelle Falls in the Columbia Gorge. And we had just gotten to the waterfall, and Betty's a great photographer, and she's constantly taking pictures, and they're good pictures. But I leaned against this tree because I said, oh, Betty, get a picture of this. This would be great to remember us by. So I leaned against a tree, and as I stood back up, in Betty's word, I was there and then I wasn't. I stepped back and stepped right off the edge. And I began to roll and tumble. And I tumbled, they said, between 30 and 40 feet. Didn't hit a rock, didn't hit a tree, just that Oregon dirt. And I landed straight on my face. And everyone, when I tell that story, says, poor Betty. That's what they all say up there. I yelled up at her and she couldn't hear me. I think I'm okay. I think I broke my arm. And I was cut and bruised and everything. And I was dazed, so I just laid there. Her and a couple hikers that were there went around and it dropped down this side. And this man came across and he helped me. And I got up and we came across the water. And I said very heroically, I'm going to hike out. So we got maybe an eighth, a quarter of a mile, I'm not even sure. And Betty kept saying, we're calling the paramedics. And I said, no, I can do it. And of course I couldn't. I don't know if I went into shock or what, but some hikers went down to the parking lot, called 911, and lo and behold, the paramedics came and put me on a board and carried me down. And to this day, Betty reminds me that I only hiked 36 miles and she hiked 37 miles. By the way, no cracks, no nothing. Just a shoulder that I'm in physical therapy for. So, oh, and by the way, Betty took pictures of the incident. She had her little camera and she was covertly taking pictures of the paramedics. And she said, if you were really, really hurt, I was going to throw them away. But if not, we'd have a good memory. And we do. We have a good memory. But what happened to me in that incident is that I tapped into a fearful place in me that I didn't think I still had inside of me. And I have felt more anxiety since August 5th than I have felt in many, many, many years. It's tapped into an unsafe place in me, and I realized that deepest core of fear in me I had exiled over here. And it was time that I brought that home, So I have been spending time just meditating on, looking to Jesus, sitting with him, quietly meditating, thinking about it. Notice this verse doesn't say, have more faith, trust more. That would be to heap guilt on our heads. He began our faith, he will finish it, he will complete it. And what about this Jesus are we to meditate on? Who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. There's so much in that verse, joy, endurance, despising, shame, such feeling words that if I had time, boy, I'd really get into those feeling words, but I'm not going to. The point is, he went through all that and now he is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. In other words, we are to meditate on, as we look to him, it is finished. It is over. The battle has been won. You can rest. Enter my rest. Enter my rest. And the last thing I saw is run learning. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. Get discouraged in your souls. That's another way of saying it. And how many of us today and what's going on in the world are discouraged in our souls? How many of us are weary and feeling like we're losing heart? And if you don't feel that today, you will tomorrow, or you did yesterday, because that's life. That's life. When that happens, we're to ponder, consider. That word means ponder, think about, grapple with. That's what that word is. Because that's how we learn. That's how we grow. That's how we grow. And you're not saying do this to feel guilty. Like I used to read this verse, consider him who's gone through all of this, and how dare you get discouraged because after all I've done for you? No. Think about it. If even Jesus, the very heart of God, went through suffering, you can know he's with you in what you're going through. You're not going through this because you're bad, because you've done something wrong. God doesn't care. Suffering is a part of life. Jesus suffered, we will suffer, but we are not alone. The concept here is never stop learning. Never stop growing. When we do, we stagnate. We get locked into rigid ways of thinking and of being, and we lose our wonder and we lose our spontaneity, and that is so sad. When I was with Jeanette, I looked under her coffee table, and there's this big honking book about yay big, and I opened it up, 1,400 and some pages in this book. And on it, it said the complete works of Oswald Chambers. Now, the only thing I knew about Oswald Chambers is he wrote this little devotional book called My Utmost for His Highest. I got it when I was 22, and I've probably been through that 15 times since then. But I had no clue anything else about the man. And you know, he wasn't a very remarkable person. He died at 43 from complications of an appendicitis operation in Cairo, Egypt. He was a teacher at a Bible college, and he was on a few boards. I just read a little bit of his biography. When he died in 1917, nobody knew him. His wife compiled some of his writings and in 1927 published My Utmost for His Highest, and that book has never been out of print since 1927. Pretty powerful. So I thought, I had no clue he wrote more. And I know that some years I'd read his works and I would say, oh gosh, this is cool, this is great, this is food for my soul. And then there'd be sometimes I'd read it and I'd think, oh, he's kind of stodgy and guilt-producing. But I'll tell you, when I picked up this book at Jeanette's, she'd gone to bed, I couldn't put it down. And I kept reading. And he was talking in there about this very verse that we've been talking about. And he says this, and I like it so much, I'm just going to take it apart for you. He says, faith is never defined. It is described, as in Hebrews 11:1, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, but it's never defined. Definitions can only be given of things that are perfectly understood and inferior to the mind that defines them. I'm not even going to try and understand that, okay? This is what he's really saying here. It's absurd to try and put God into a definition. If I can define God, then I am greater than God. Wow, that's humbling. Intellectual definition is of no use whatsoever in the spiritual life. Faith cannot be intellectually defined, for it is the inborn capacity to see God behind everything, the wonder that keeps you an eternal child. What is your faith to you, he asks, a wonderful thing or something small, narrow, cloistered, self-contained? Satisfaction, he says, is too often the peace of death. Let me repeat that. Satisfaction is too often the peace of death. Wonder is the very essence of life. And then he says, beware always of losing your wonder. And the first thing that stops wonder is religious conviction. Whenever you give a trite testimony, the wonder is gone. The only evidence of salvation or sanctification, which is growth, is that the sense of wonder is developing, not at things as they are, but at the one who made them as they are. There's not a set definition of faith into which all these men and women in Hebrews 11 can fall into. They were heroes because they endured as seeing him who is invisible. He says the acts of faith that these writers refer to, they weren't performed by astute-minded men and women who made defined statements about God. How many times have I made some defined statement about God? Just blows me away and humbles me. They were not tortured for conviction's sake, but for the sake of their faith. There is no mention of salvation of sin. The one point insisted upon is their faith. And God is training us to do what they did. Live a life of tenacious hold upon God in spite of everything that happens. And then he says, faith is the indefinable certainty. Now, if that's not an oxymoron, indefinable certainty of God behind everything. And so we look to Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, and we learn to live with mystery. Catherine Hermas, one of my favorite writers on the contemplative lifestyle, contemplative prayer, says, God will lead us to where we think we know, to where we don't know, to where we give up all knowing. There is a sweet dissatisfaction that we're going to have to live with the rest of our lives. Let me repeat that. There is a sweet dissatisfaction that we are going to have to live with the rest of our lives. And that sweet dissatisfaction can be our greatest treasure, and it can be our most prized possession. And that is our hunger for home and our longing for God. Now, I want to close by introducing you to two other people. This is Adeline Rose Daggett and Jack Edgar Daggett. And they are kind of the center of our family right now, the center of our world. She's 2.5, he's 6 months. I, along with Grandma Sherry and Grandma Sandy, I'm Auntie, I get a chance to help on a more minor level than the two grandmas do, taking care of them, as Lindsay's a school teacher. I adore those children. I adore them. If you don't have kids in your life, you need to find some kids. Adopt some. One day, my brother-in-law, Ed, had just taken over as general manager at Hops Valley out in Springfield. And we were there having dinner, the family. And Lindsay said, Aunt, would you take Addie to the bathroom? She was holding Jack. And I'm Aunt. It's too hard to explain I'm not Aunt Jackie, but I'm just Aunt. Will you take Addie to the bathroom? So I did. I take Addie to the bathroom, and I lift her up. I wipe off the seat. I lift her up, and I set her down, and she finishes, and I reach over to the toilet paper to say to Addie, honey, do you need help? Addie, do you need Auntie to help? And she stared right at my face, locked into my eyes, and said as calmly as anything, no, Auntie, I got it. And I, of course, went out and told the whole family, guess what Addie said, and all of that stuff. And you know, what happened, though, were those three words kept rolling in my mind in that little, wonderful toddler's voice for the next weeks, even into the next month. I got it. I got it. I got it. And then as I was struggling with anxiety after going through this fall and tapping into some places I didn't know were there, I was struggling reading somewhere one morning in my chair that I like to sit in, and Addie's little girl voice morphed in to the still, quiet voice inside of me of God. And I, not audibly, but heard, Jackie, I got it. I got it. So let me just leave you with some thoughts. If you're here today and you feel lost, maybe, just maybe, in the quietness of your heart, you can hear him say, I am the way. I got it. Or if you're here and you feel confused, what is the truth? I don't know. Maybe, in the quietness of your heart, you can hear him say, I am the truth. I got it. Or maybe you feel dead inside. Maybe you can hear him say, I am the life. I got it. When you fear you won't have enough, you're not going to have enough. Maybe you can hear that still small voice inside saying, I am the bread of life. I am the substance. I've got it. I've got it. And when you fear the future, who's going to take care of me? What's going to happen? Listen to his voice quietly say to you, I am the good shepherd. I got it. When you think you can't be forgiven, you're struggling with brokenness in your life, just maybe you can hear him quietly say, this is my body broken for you. This is my blood shed for you. It is finished. I am now seated at the right hand of the throne of God. It is finished. I got it. If you're here today and you're afraid of dying, or worse still, you're afraid of living, perhaps you can hear his voice say, I am the resurrection and the life. I got it. So, out of the mouth of a toddler who was doing nothing more than what she's supposed to be doing, learning a life skill, differentiating, growing, I heard the voice of God. Thank you.
Thanks so much.